You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Israeli forces have killed a female Palestinian paramedic in the Gaza Strip. The 21-year-old woman was shot dead near the so-called buffer zone east of the city of Khan Yunis. She was helping the wounded. Clashes also erupted between Palestinian protesters and Israeli forces in the West Bank. Nearly 100 demonstrators were wounded in both Gaza and the West Bank. 127 Palestinians have been killed since March 30th, when Palestinians announced the beginning of the Great March of Return rallies. The protests revive a long-standing demand for the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homeland. Well, joining us live now from Gaza City is Press TV's correspondent Ashraf Shannon. Ashraf, what more can you tell us about the tragic killing of this 21-year-old young Palestinian paramedic?
Yes, Waqar, 21-year-old Rozana Najjar has been helping the wounded since March 30th, since the start of the Great March of Return. She was working as a volunteer paramedic, helping those who are suffering from tear gas and helping evacuate the wounded. This evening, Israeli snipers shot her in the chest, and she died about 20 minutes later upon arrival at the hospital. Today also, Israeli forces injured 100 peaceful protesters, including 40 with live ammunition, and at least one of them has suffered critical injury after being shot in the neck. Thousands of people have been taking part in today's protest along the so-called buffer zone east of the besieged enclave in Rafah, Khan Yunis, Al Buraij, east of Gaza City, and east of the northern Gaza Strip town of Jabalia. The theme of today's protest was a message of unity from Gaza to Haifa. This is what they call it in reference to the occupied Palestinian city of Haifa that's currently under the control of the Israeli regime. The protesters seem very adamant to continue their protest until achieving the right of return, and also to draw the world's attention to the suffering of 2 million Palestinians under more than a decade of Israeli siege that has taken its toll on all aspects of life. Now, with the injury of 100 more people in Gaza, this will only put more pressure on the health sector in the Gaza Strip that's been suffering under the cruel Israeli siege, and also from the influx of the thousands of people who were injured due to Israel's use of excessive force and Israel's shoot-to-kill policy against the protesters.
And Ashraf, do tell us as well about this ongoing protest movement as well. With these ongoing killings of medics, of even journalists and others, is this stopping the momentum when it comes to supporting this movement?
Definitely not. I mean, every time you go there to east of Gaza, you see paramedics. Most of them don't even receive salaries and going there as volunteers, helping the people. This is the second paramedic to be killed since the beginning of the Great March of Return, and two journalists were killed. Dozens of paramedics and journalists were also injured. And despite the Israeli violence and the increasing violence, people continue to go there from all walks of life, young and old, male and female. They're there, and they want the whole world to hear their voices.
Very well, Ashraf, we'll leave there at that, but of course, as always, we appreciate your reporting for us.
The monsters came just the other day. Hold us down, risen hearts. battles with freedom's cry, resistance is all around. Death knell for the crown.
Hello, brothers and sisters. This is Back in the USSR. I am Siegfried. That was a song by Brendan McFarlane. Other wisdom is Bic, Irish rebel singer from the north of Ireland in the 1980s. Monsters, Devils, and Strangers. It's a song about anti-colonial struggle in Ireland, South Africa, and in Nicaragua. A song of international solidarity. And if you recall, last week's show focused on the May 14th massacre in the Gaza Strip, in which 62 unarmed Palestinian civilians lost their lives to Israeli sniper fire in a case of cold-blooded murder. And that Press TV report I just played in the introduction there, it talks about the death of the latest victim of Israeli repression in Gaza, a young Palestinian paramedic who was shot down in cold blood yesterday. Razan Ashraf Abdul Qadir al-Najjar, 21, was helping treat and evacuate wounded protesters east of Khan Yunis when she was fatally shot in the back on Friday evening. And she was about 100 meters away from the boundary fence with Israel at the moment she was shot and was wearing clothing clearly identifying her as a medic. But nonetheless, the monsters came for her and they shot and killed her nonetheless. Now, 2 weeks ago, I couldn't bring myself to do my show because talking about this atrocity, this massacre that took place on the 14th of last month, was so overwhelming that I just couldn't do it. Instead, I went to a spoken word poetry event and performed a poem by Irish hunger striker Bobby Sands, a man who was fighting for the liberation of his own people against colonialism and who stood in full solidarity with the Palestinian cause during his lifetime, as well as anti-colonial struggles the world over. That poem was The Rhythm of Time, one of the most iconic poems that he did. He did loads and loads of poems, but that was really the most iconic one, the one maybe the most people know about. And a few days ago, just this past week, I received a response to last week's show. And to this poem by Bobby Sands in particular, it was on the CFRU Volunteers Facebook group after I'd posted about the show there. And I'm not going to name names, but I think it's important to read the response in full. And I'm just going to quote it here. Quote, "I just want to confirm what you are saying. Are you talking about the hunger strikers who were members of the Provisional Irish Republican Army, a.k.a. the IRA, because they were a terrorist group who bombed the hell out of mainland Britain, killing both military and civilians indiscriminately. I lived in London during those times, and it was no fun. They chose the bullet over the ballot box. I am absolutely disgusted that I have to read this garbage on a public CFRU feed. If you want to cry for cold-blooded murderers in your own space and your own time, so be it. I don't want to read and hear propaganda about a proscribed and internationally acknowledged terrorist group or their members. From CFRU, before you cry for a bunch of dead mass killers, spare a thought for their dead, maimed victims. There was no war. It was a terrorist operation against the United Kingdom. They're burning in hell for their crimes. End quote. Note that there were some serious spelling errors in the message I just read. So there you have it. A very hostile response to the show I did last week. You know, the mainstream media has clearly struck here at CFRU in the form of this message, and so has the dominant narrative. That has historically sought to criminalize anti-colonial struggle by oppressed people all around the world, not just in Ireland. And because I speak and have spoken in an uncompromising way in my support for anti-colonial movements, we have people who say I shouldn't be here. You know, according to them, apparently I'm just some quirky person whose deplorable opinions should be isolated behind closed doors and never given a public hearing, even on community radio, which, let's face it, doesn't have a massive audience. My response to this person and that message, you know, a hateful message against the movement for freedom in Northern Ireland, a hateful message towards Bobby Sands, who of course gave his own life for that movement, you know, and really a hateful response to anti-colonial struggles the world over. And my response to this person was that he should educate himself on the real history of places like Ireland and Palestine and understand the impact that colonialism and empire have had there before he goes around spewing this kind of vitriol and venom. Because yes, the IRA used violence in its campaign against British occupation in Ireland, just as the Palestinian Liberation Organization did in Palestine against Israeli apartheid, just as the African National Congress, the ANC, did in South Africa when it fought against apartheid. In each case, that violence was directed against an apartheid regime, armed to the teeth, backed by sectarian death squads that were killing people. You know, just shooting people down in the streets, just like what happened on May 14th in Gaza. You know, fighting against a regime that was not afraid to gun down innocent civilians in cold blood. All these three movements, whether that was in Northern Ireland or in Palestine or in South Africa, these were national liberation movements fighting against settler colonialism. They were fighting against settler colonialism, and they were resisting the brutal oppression and occupation of their respective peoples at the hands of the colonizer. And they were willing to fight back by any means necessary. I want people just to listen to this clip right here.
I am a representative of the General Headquarters staff of Aughlin Aharon, the IRA. I don't see any merit in discussing individuals as targets. Suffice it to say that the people who legislate for the terror in Ireland know well that they all remain targets. And I'm sure that Mrs. Thatcher, when she goes down upon her knees with a mirror checking underneath her car every morning, remembers the terror she inflicted on Ireland.
We're not going to be firing yet, are we, man?
Our strategy is that through the effective use of guerrilla warfare and through continually maintaining an effective fighting force, we will eventually sap the political will of the British government to remain in Ireland. If the British government were prepared to show even one iota of leadership and were to begin moves to disengage from this country, then the conflict would cease.
So that was a message that the General Headquarters staff of the IRA actually put out in 1992. And just to put this in context, just as the IRA set off bombs in Manchester and London, the ANC, the African National Congress, set off bombs in Pretoria and Johannesburg, in South Africa. The latter city was swathed in black smoke for 24 hours in 1980 when the ANC, Nelson Mandela's organization, blew up three oil refineries in an effort to starve the apartheid state's military machine of fuel. Does that make them evil? Does it make Hamas evil for finally returning fire against Israel this past week with mortar shells after 2 months? 2 months of the Israeli army slaughtering unarmed Palestinian demonstrators, at least 129 of whom now lie dead without a single Israeli injury or fatality? The first recorded use of firearms by the Provisional IRA, you know, the organization that this, the person who wrote this hateful message against me on the CFRU feed, the organization he hates so much, the first recorded use of firearms by the Provisional IRA in Northern Ireland during the so-called Troubles was on the 27th of June, 1970, when the British-backed Ulster Volunteer Force, a hardcore sectarian Protestant militia that was government-backed and was effectively terrorizing, you know, had been terrorizing the Catholic population in Northern Ireland for years before that time. On the 27th of June, 1970, the UVF militia attempted to overrun the Catholic neighborhood of Short Strand in Northern Ireland. And the IRA defended the neighborhood and killed five of the attacking militiamen. You know, of course, who had been murdering and displacing Catholic people from their homes throughout the 1960s. And really, of course, like that had been turning what had been a much more mixed society, you know, where Catholics and Protestants have been living side by side. It turned into that terrorism by the UVF, by these government-backed forces, like basically terror groups, you know, like government-backed terror groups that were going after like Catholics in Northern Ireland and killing them and displacing them. That had turned that society into a segregated society, like really an apartheid society. And that was reinforced by law. And of course, there's laws about who, you know, where Catholics can work, where Catholics can live, you know, limits on their, you know, their rights on like all these different things, you know, on their civil rights were seriously circumscribed. So what happened in 1970 and the 27th of June, 1970 was self-defense on the part of the IRA, defending a Catholic neighborhood against a vicious assault. By a group of people who wanted to displace and murder people. And self-defense is not a crime. But people like my challenger here have a real tendency to deplore violence only when it's done by oppressed people defending themselves and resisting state violence. You know, it's all too easy. The mainstream media demonizes the hell out of oppressed people for defending themselves, and shapes public opinion to the point where it doesn't cost a thing to talk trash about the colonized. I mean, we see, like, I mean, last week I even had some excerpts from like the New York Times and different mainstream media outlets in the United States and from the BBC as well, and like some other mainstream Western news sources. And the things that they were saying about the people of Gaza, you know, who've been protesting against, you know, for their rights as refugees, as their right to return to their ancestral lands that had been stolen from them, you know, by the Israeli occupying power. And they were marching peacefully, marching unarmed, and yet they were still shot down, you know, in dozens and dozens and hundreds of them shot down and killed by Israeli sniper fire. That didn't stop the mainstream media from trying to blame the Palestinians for their own deaths, you know, and for their own, you know, as if they were bringing this upon themselves. And the mainstream media did all it could to, you know, deny the guilt of the real killers. You know, those men with the sniper rifles, those heavily armed soldiers of an Israeli apartheid regime who were shooting down people in cold blood. They did their best to exonerate them. while trying to blame the colonized, blame the Palestinians for their own deaths, their own oppression. It was very disgusting, as I said last week. But of course they do that. And of course the very same people who write that those kind of stories, those kind of news stories, they have zero problem with the cops getting violent with oppressed people, or the army getting violent, or the people who the army and the police hire to do their dirty work for them from getting violent. Because all that's legitimate force in their eyes. You know, they believe in the state. They believe in the capitalist state, and when it commits violence, that's cool. Or if it isn't cool, then it must be a one-time aberration. But it's never systemic, not to them. You know, they think the state, when it, whatever it does, it's legitimate. And if you fight against state violence, however, you know, if you fight against the colonizer, you know, you are evil, monstrous, child-murdering scum from hell. You know, that's their point of view. So it comes as no surprise that they don't care. They don't care that the armed struggle in Northern Ireland only began after masses of Irish Catholic civilians were forced out of their homes and driven out of entire neighborhoods by state-backed sectarian thugs, you know, like the UVF, and turned into refugees in their own land in the 1960s. I mean, they don't care that the armed struggle only really started after the British government cracked down on a peaceful mass movement for civil rights. You know, who have been protesting peacefully against, you know, thousands and thousands of people protesting peacefully against the apartheid policies being pursued in Ulster by the British government and against the systemic discrimination that had been, you know, unleashed against Catholics. You know, and how the British government responded to these demonstrations by imprisoning thousands of people without trial. You know, through internment, and creating a full-on police state, and shooting 14 unarmed protesters dead in the city of Derry on Bloody Sunday, 1972. I mean, they don't care about the police raids, the interrogation centers, the systemic torture of prisoners. You know, Bobby Sands was one of them who was tortured horribly. You know, and the state-backed sectarian death squads who murdered, you know, Catholic people, like civilians in cold blood, you know, simply for being Catholic, and the enforced segregation of the populace into different neighborhoods, you know, and, you know, a brutal occupation by the British Army and the creation of a fully fledged apartheid system in the north of Ireland, imposed on the Irish people by the British Crown. You know, they're not interested in that, any of that, you know. But the truth is, armed self-defense, and this is crucial to understand, armed self-defense only begins when peaceful movements are assaulted by the state and civil rights struggles are drowned in blood. I mean, it was the same thing in South Africa. Throughout the 1950s, the African National Congress and its allied organizations and trade unions engaged in strikes, boycotts, massive peaceful protests for black civil rights in South Africa, mobilizing hundreds of thousands of people against the apartheid state, you know, peaceful unarmed demonstrations. And of course, the South African government's response was brutal repression, you know, massacres in the streets leading up to the infamous Sharpeville massacre on March 21st, 1960, when 83 unarmed black people were shot down in cold blood by the police and another 365 were injured. I mean, it was only after this and other massacres, you know, and the banning of opposition parties and trade unions and brutal, heavy-handed police state tactics directed against anyone resisting apartheid rule, that the ANC began its armed struggle in the 1960s. And it was the same thing in the U.S. in the 1960s when the Black Panther Party really began pushing for armed self-defense, only after brutal state repression against the black community and the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. You know, and today it's the same thing in Palestine, you know, with militant forces in Gaza only opening fire on Israel after 2 months of the Israeli army drowning peaceful protests in blood. And I want to quote Michael Parenti on this something he said in his book, Black Shirts and Reds. And it goes like this, quote, "Most social revolutions begin peaceably. Most social revolutions begin peaceably. Why would it be otherwise? Who would not prefer to assemble and demonstrate rather than engage in mortal combat against pitiless forces that enjoy every advantage in mobility and firepower? Revolutions in Russia, China, Vietnam, and El Salvador all began peacefully, with crowds of peasants and workers launching nonviolent protests only to be met with violent oppression from the authorities. Peaceful protest and reform are exactly what the people are denied by the ruling oligarchs. The dissidents who continue to fight back, who try to defend themselves from the oligarchs' repressive fury, are then called violent revolutionaries and terrorists." And that was definitely the case in Northern Ireland, that was the case in South Africa, and that is the case today in Palestine. And what Michael Parenti raises here, you know, about how these kind of movements begin peacefully, and then they only become armed insurrections when they are forced to, you know, after facing dreadful repression at the hands of the authorities. That's an important distinction, an important point, because those revolutions, and I almost want to put that in quotes, that do begin violently, you know, with armed gangs going around attacking security forces, murdering government supporters, burning buildings, and using intimidation to recruit people, you know, those, quote, revolutions are probably not wholly indigenous efforts at political reform, but Western-backed regime change efforts. And so we see this in the case of Syria, Venezuela, and most recently in Nicaragua, with right-wing opposition forces rejecting talks, rejecting mediation, rejecting reform efforts, and really rejecting anything less than the complete overthrow of the governments of those countries, all of which are currently targeted by the United States for destruction. And these movements, these right-wing movements, they're violent from the start. They often have support from local elites who want the overthrow of progressive policies and governments in those countries. And most importantly, they have the support of the world's only superpower, which is a major reason why they don't feel any incentive to negotiate or compromise. You know, why compromise when you've got the U.S. backing you to the hilt? You know, a country as powerful as the U.S. backing you to the hilt. Why be nonviolent when you've got the U.S. and the Western media encouraging you and solely blaming the government for any violence that happens? You know, why push for reform when you think you can have it all through a regime change operation spearheaded by your backers in Washington? You know, this is a major distinction that needs to be made between those, you know, legitimate struggles for national liberation, like what you saw in South Africa against apartheid and what you saw in Northern Ireland and what you see in Palestine. And you compare those movements to the kind of movements that you see, these right-wing movements that you get going up against the Bolivarian government in Venezuela, or like the Sandinista government in Nicaragua, or the Ba'athist Syrian government too. You know, all these ones which are Western-backed, you know, backed to the hilt by the West, by NATO, and have all kinds of funding, all kinds of arms, all the money they could ever want. These are the ones that are violent from the start. These are the movements that are violent from the start. I mean, contrast that with the painful compromises that the ANC, IRA, and PLO were willing to make in the 1990s in order to have peace in South Africa, Northern Ireland, and Palestine. You know, painful compromises that those societies are in many cases still suffering from right now, you know, the consequences of. Especially in Palestine, where the Oslo Accords of 1994 effectively provided a front for Israeli colonization and settlement of the West Bank and the end of any realistic hope for a two-state solution. But nonetheless, they were willing to compromise. So getting back to the friendly letter from a fellow CFRU volunteer that I quoted at the beginning of the show, no, Bobby Sands and his comrades are not burning in hell for upholding the self-determination of their people in the face of a brutally oppressive colonial power. That was oppressing and murdering them. I mean, 10 brave men gave up their lives on hunger strike in 1981 in Northern Ireland. Bobby Sands, Francis Hughes, Raymond McCreesh, Patsy O'Hara, Joe McDonnell, Martin Herson, Kevin Lynch, Kieran Doherty, Thomas McElwee, and Mickey Devine. And they made that ultimate sacrifice because they refused to be criminalized by a colonial system that was oppressing their people. They were not common criminals and terrorists, as the British government tried to make them out to be, but political prisoners. And I just want to take a pause right now and play a song about Ray McCreesh, one of those 10 brave men who would not be criminalized. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I remember from my boyhood that in South Armagh I'd lie beneath that evening sky and search for shooting stars. Often would I wonder what I would grow to be, but fate would choose a different course. My name is Ray McCreesh. What kind of a system would bring a people to their knees? Try to break their spirits and rob their dignity. With injustice all around me, I knew something must be done. While others learned indifference, I learned to hold a gun. Captured and imprisoned through in an H block cell, 4 years on a blanket protest, I served my time in hell. Denied of any status, they called my cause a crime. So on a hunger strike I joined to prove their words were lies. As my time was fast approaching, the Lord took me by the hand. He said, once more I bear witness to man's inhumanity to man. Another martyr for old Ireland, another thorn in my crown. You've done your time upon the cross, my son, I'll help you down. If you're ever up in Camla, in my native South Armagh, and you gaze upon that evening sky and see a shooting star, just remember that this young boy used to dream his young boy dreams. Think of me when you whisper prayers. My name is Ray McCreesh. Think of me when you whisper prayers. My name is Ray McCreesh.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Chris McGill with My Name is Ray McCreesh. Yeah, Chris McGill with My Name is Ray McCreesh. And that song, of course, is a tribute to Ray McCreesh, one of the 10 men, of course, including Bobby Sands, who gave their lives on hunger strike in 1981 in Northern Ireland. It needs to be pointed out that bandits and murderers don't starve themselves to death for a set of political demands, nor do they walk unarmed in front of sniper rifles trained on them by a ruthless occupying army in order to demand the right of return to the land that they were driven from as refugees more than 70 years ago. These people are not terrorists. They are fighting for the liberation of their people from a system that treated them as subhuman. You know, black South Africans, Palestinians, and Northern Irish Catholics were all treated as subhuman by a system that did, and in the case of Palestine still does, force them into squalid urban ghettos or impoverished rural Bantustans under military occupation and police terror, while colonizers and settlers stole their lands, just like what happened to indigenous peoples in North and South America. Gaza, as you know, has been called the world's biggest open-air prison. And this is another song I'm going to play, which talks about what that kind of persecution does to people and why people do resist. It's another song, of course, from Northern Ireland and from the time of the hunger strike in 1981. This is Christy Moore with 90 Miles. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I'm 90 miles from Dublin town. I'm in the hedge block sound. To help you understand my plight, the story now I'll tell. I'm on the blanket protest, my efforts must not fail. For I'm joined by men and women in Bakesh and Armagel. It all began one morning I was dragged to Castlereagh. And though it was 3 years ago, it seems like yesterday. For 3 days kicked and beaten, I then was forced to sign confessions that convicted me of crimes that were not mine. Sentenced in a Diplock court, my protest it began. I could not wear their prison gear, I was a blanket man. I'll not exempt their status, I'll not be criminalized. That's the issue in the blocks for which we give our lives. Over there in London town, oh how they'd laugh and sneer if they could only make us wear their loathsome prison gear. Prisoners of war is what we are, and that we must remain. The blanket protest cannot end till status we're again. I've been beaten round the romper room because I won't say sir. I've been frog marched down the landing and dragged back by the hair. I've suffered degradation, humility and pain. Still the spirit does not falter, British torture is in vain. I've been held in scalding water while my skin with thick scrubs was tore. I've been scratched and cut from head to foot, then thrown out on the floor. I've suffered mirror searches, been probed by drunken bears. I've heard my comrades cry and scream, then utter useless prayers. Now with the news that's coming in,
our protest must not fail. For now we're joined by 30 girls in Armagh Women's Jail. So pay attention, Irish men and Irish women too, and show the Free State rulers that their silence will not do. Though it's 90 miles to Dublin town, it seems so far away. There's more attention to our plight in the USA. Now you've heard the story of this filthy living hell. Remember, 90 miles away, I'm still in me hedge block cell.
Listening to Back in the USSR, that was Christy Moore with 90 Miles, song about the blanket protest in Northern Ireland in the early 1980s, protesting against British rule and the criminalization of political prisoners. And they refused to be criminalized, of course. And that's, of course, what led to the hunger strikes, in which Bobby Sands gave his life. Now, under international law, the UN Charter, I mean, all that clearly states that colonized peoples have the right to resist colonialism, wherever that is in the world. And in a message smuggled out of Robben Island, where he had been held prisoner since 1962, Nelson Mandela declared in the 1980s that, quote, the soil of our country is destined to be the scene of the fiercest fight and the sharpest battles to rid our continent of the last vestiges of white minority rule. The world is on our side. The OAU and the UN and the anti-apartheid movement continue to put pressure on the racist rulers of our country. Every effort to isolate South Africa adds strength to our struggle. And at all levels of our struggle, within and outside the country, much has been achieved and much remains to be done. But victory is certain. End quote. And victory will also be achieved. Victory was achieved in South Africa over apartheid. And victory will also be achieved in Palestine, in Ireland, and everywhere colonialism remains to be defeated, including Canada. With regard to Palestine, just as was the case in South Africa, a boycott and sanctions movement is growing in strength. It's getting harder and harder for celebrities, academics, and others to go to apartheid Israel and collaborate with the establishment there without facing international condemnation. The U.S. is now almost completely isolated when it vetoes resolutions at the UN condemning Israeli crimes against humanity. And even though it will be a hard struggle going forward, I fully believe that victory is indeed certain. Palestine will be free, and all oppressed nations around the world will have their freedom and their liberation. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Famous man, we must be united, and man. By 1976, the conflict in the north of Ireland had claimed over 1,500 lives. In its war against the Republican movement, the British government's focus shifted to the prisons. All those convicted after 1st of March 1976 were to be treated as criminals and held in a new prison, the H Blocks.
They tried here to force the prison gear on me in the reception area. I resisted.
And he said, put uniform on. And I said, not put uniform on because I'm a political prisoner and I'm not wearing no prison uniform.
It went without saying Republican prisoners did not view themselves as criminals. Never did, and they never will.
Government standing against the wall and strip off and put my clothes under a brown bag and I'd strip down my underpants. And the guy came out again and says, I said strip, get the fucking heap off. So I stripped off naked through the underpants into the bag.
you were standing in the circle in front of all these screws, forced to strip naked, and you were just all the usual snide remarks, the jeers, the jokes, all the usual rubbish coming from.
There can be no question of political status for someone who is serving a sentence for crime. Crime is crime is crime. It is not political, it is crime.
The talk was that H3 was not the block to go to. If you could avoid H3, you'd be doing all right. I just heard them shouting, H3, and I just remember, oh God, you know, that's what I didn't want.
I was trailed by the hair, kicked into the classroom. I was stripped naked. They threw me a towel. They gave me a towel. And even when I was trying to walk with a towel, they kept pulling the towel off me when they'd bring me down to the cell.
I remember walking down the wing, and you feel very awkward for a start if you're walking no clothes and no shoes on, so it's a bit awkward walking anyway. But the other thing was, you know, what do you do with your hands? Do you put them over your braves as if you're... Then that feels as if you're embarrassed, you know, but at the same time, you're not going to sort of march down the wing, you know, your arms are there, because that's not how you're feeling either. So I remember sort of feeling, you know, your hands were like lumps of lead just by your side somewhere, you know.
Refusing to wear the uniform, the men wrapped themselves in blankets to hide their nakedness. And so began the blanket protest. It was to become one of the most remarkable prison protests in history. This is the story of the men who lived it, what gave them hope, how they lifted their morale, and what kept their spirits alive.
In the H blocks, you were locked in a cell, and because you were a protesting prisoner at that particular stage, at the early stage of protest, you were able to get out of your cell and go to the toilet. That was about it. If you took a visit, you were able to get out of your cell. If you went to mass, you could get out of your cell. Other than that, we were confined to our cells 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, etc. So I remember, this is me. I mean, here, this is me, this is the H blocks.
I think the first number of years, you're still very much ahead, still very much on the outside. So it's a Saturday night, you're thinking about what you would have been doing on a Saturday night, or what your mates are now doing, or you'd be thinking about your family, or what was going on there, or the places you would start to go, because you're starting to hear new things and be curious about things. So now it's about also the things you would do which you never would have thought of when you're outside. So the outside world is a big occupation. The thing is, I mean, I'd have paced up and down the cell for about 10 hours a day, and that's a, you know, that's a lot of time to be, and you're just thinking thoughts, imaginary thoughts. You're doing things about Irish and such like, but you'd end up, I suppose, holding totally imaginary conversations with different people. Maybe people who are in the jail but you don't have access to, or people who are on the outside. So it's, yeah, in many ways, it's, you create a bit of an imaginary world in your head.
To defeat the system, they would need to be able to dictate the pace of the protest. Escalation was inevitable. Confined to their cells, the immediate enemy became the prison staff, and the authorities would seek every opportunity to undermine their spirit.
Food and tobacco were things that definitely affected the morale of the wing. The particular screw in charge of the wing, his policy was, well, there wasn't brutality, it was to generally starve us. Like, the portions were just outrageous. You know, you could literally count the number of cornflakes on the bowl. The bowls themselves were smaller than in any other block. They were like saucers. So you could maybe count it. Somebody one morning shouted over, I think it was Sean Coleman, he had 11 cornflakes. And this was mixed with milk and water, you know, the water down the milk. In the evening, you got a cup of tea and cake, and it was just yellow cake that used to come round that a lot of people hated. And it's funny because Kieran Dougherty, who died in the hunger strike, used to be saying that anybody didn't want the yellow cake, to swing it up to him. And at the time, there was no windows. It smashed the windows and they were open, so you could... the bit of a towel that we used wasn't a towel, it was a piece of like a white linen, but you could use it to put your arm out and swing from one cell to another. So like, people would actually swung down the yellow cake down to Big Duck. I think it was the idea of just having something to eat rather than nothing.